Hi there, and welcome to A Different Way of Seeing. Have you ever wondered how a disabled person lives their life? Join our host, Lois Drachen, as she chats to people about work, education, travel, sport, the arts, and leisure, and the tools and techniques they use to live their lives with the disability. And now, on with the show.
Hi there, it's Lois. In South Africa, the 3rd of November to the 3rd of December is Disability Rights Awareness Month. Also, World Diabetes Day is celebrated on the 14th of November each year, a day which just happens to be my birthday. This month, I will be sharing a two-part interview that was led by friend and colleague Jeremy Opperman, in which I talk about the implications of living as a diabetic who is blind and now has chronic kidney disease. I hope you enjoy this two-part episode, which will come out in the month of November. As always, my thanks to Hindenburg.com for the sponsorship of the software to produce this episode. Hindenburg, it's all about the story. Hi there, and welcome to today's episode of A Different Way of Seeing, a podcast where we talk all things disability. I'm usually your host. My name is Lois Strachan, and usually I'm in the driving seat asking the questions of a guest who joins me on the episode. Today we're doing something a little bit different. I have asked a friend and colleague, Jeremy Opperman, to help host this show and guide me through a conversation with the questions that he asks. And that's because we're talking about something that is particularly personal in my life, and that is my journey with type 1 or childhood onset diabetes, my subsequent blindness, which was a result of my diabetes, and more recently, my diagnosis with chronic kidney disease and starting on dialysis, and what that has all been like for me as a blind woman living a fairly active life. So, Jeremy, welcome to A Different Way of Seeing. Thank you for joining us back on the show. And thanks for agreeing to lead this conversation for me, because
thank you.
I think it's important to get the information out. But I know in myself that I have a tendency to be distracted. So I thought it would be easier to ask you to come on board and to help me just to shape the conversation. So thanks for being willing to do that.
Brilliant. Thanks, Lois, for having me back. It's good to be back on the show. And I think it's going to be very interesting. As you say, you're normally in the driver's seat, and I've been on the other side of that desk with you actually quite a few times on the show. So it's going to be fun, actually, reversing the tables somewhat. And I think what's so important about this is that it's a really important issue, not just in the world of blind people and diabetes, but globally. The issue of diabetes is becoming a very serious global phenomenon. And we need to, the more awareness people can have about the implications of this disease, the better. So, Lois, to begin with, I mean, you and I have known each other for well over 20 years. And I've always known you as a blind person, but obviously everyone has a beginning. I began my blindness, obviously with low vision when I was young, but you, of course, aren't that particular. You didn't begin your blindness at birth or as an early child, but diabetes is clearly integral to your blindness. And so I'd like to ask, when was it that you actually were first diagnosed with early onset diabetes as a child?
I will answer the question, Jeremy, but I've just got a quick request. I've just noticed that your video doesn't appear to be on. Are you okay sharing the video as well? Because I would like to put this onto YouTube. Great. So let's just get...
Oh, of course. Sorry. I didn't even notice.
There we go. Video now.
There we go. Well, I'm sorry about that.
Not a problem. I will include the start of this, but then just make a note in the YouTube video that there's the first few minutes are just purely audio, but that the video does come on. So thank you for doing that. Okay, so when was I diagnosed with my childhood onset diabetes? I was about 6 years old at the time, and it was back in the 1970s.
The mid-70s.
And I think the reason I think that's important to mention is that in recent years, there's been a lot more awareness of diabetes, a lot more awareness amongst the medical profession of the preferred or the ideal treatment of diabetes, the danger signs that maybe, just maybe, might not have been as front of mind first diagnosed.
Let's go there, because it's what I mean. I have a very vivid memory of my childhood. Do you have a memory of a good memory of yourself before diabetes? In other words, can you remember it well enough between 1 and 6?
I have clear memories of certain things happening when I was very, very young. And likewise, after my diagnosis of diabetes, I don't know that those memories are necessarily clear. I don't know that they are necessarily in a clear timeline. But we can certainly dive into what I do remember and see how that feeds into the conversation.
Well, what I'm getting at really is before and after. So do you remember what it was, what it felt like, which ultimately resulted in a diagnosis? So what was it in you that made you feel different enough to be able to have it dealt with? What was that like? Can you remember that transition of before diabetes and after?
I remember certain things of it. I remember as a 3 or 4 year old visiting South Africa before my diagnosis, and I was living in the UK at the moment, or at that time. And I remember coming to South Africa, spending time with my cousins and all of us enjoying sugarcane. I remember that sort of thing. And then when we moved to South Africa, it was just before I started schooling, but I think the relevance of this conversation really starts with my schooling. When I was in about standard one, I remember very much that I seemed to be constantly thirsty, constantly drinking water, drinking juice, drinking, and having to put my hand up in class and ask my teacher for permission to go to the bathroom so that I could drink liquid. And then subsequently stick my hand up in class to ask my teacher permission to then go to the bathroom, because I was drinking so much liquid and having the natural consequences. So I remember that quite clearly. And then the next phase of the treatment is I remember also feeling very tired. Very sluggish, not really wanting to be active. And so that sort of symptom.
Okay, well, let's go there, Lois, because this is important. So the thirst and the fatigue are these, I'm no expert in diabetes. After a lifetime of diabetes, you patently know more than most, I suspect. So is this an issue? Is this a thing, the thirst? Therefore, also, you know, drinking a great deal and therefore needing to go to the loo, and also the fatigue. Is that a thing? Is that an indicator of early diabetes?
I don't know enough about diabetes generally to be able to say, yes, those are symptoms that each person will experience. Otherwise, their diagnosis is not going to result in diabetes. But
right.
I can tell you about my journey. And yes, there were symptoms for me. And my understanding of that, for the reasons of that, is that the fatigue, the sluggishness, the constant thirst was a result of too much sugar being in my bloodstream. So my blood being consequently a little bit thicker, a little more sluggish, my body not working as well, that need for water to thin down the blood as much as possible and to then get as much of the sugar out of the body. At least that's how I understand it. So my kind of suspicion is that those may be symptoms that other people may feel in a similar space.
And we mustn't forget that this was quite literally 50 years ago.
So
things have moved on, and there's a great deal of difference now in terms of diagnostics, which would make it easier, I suspect. So once you're diagnosed, what happens? There's a big change, I'm sure.
The crisis point in my journey actually came where one night I had a friend staying over with me and I started feeling really, really ill. I was nauseous repeatedly. I was very, very unable to do anything. And not physically, I just didn't have the energy. And at one stage, I went into a coma, at which point I understood that my parents contacted my friend's the family and asked if my friend could be dropped home. And they then phoned for an ambulance and they got me into a hospital. And I then came round in a hospital ward. And this one I do remember quite clearly. I was
really
in,
you can
I
remember
was,
that.
Yeah, I was in a bed with bars up on a drip, and I had a black eye.
No,
because I had been in the bed, and I had decided it was now time to get up and get ready for school. And I climbed out of the bed, tripped over the drip stand, and gave myself a black eye on the cabinet next to the bed.
No.
So I was in an ICU ward, and at that stage they were running some diagnostic tests, as a result of which the diagnosis came back that I was diabetic. And yeah, from there, I don't actually remember a lot about those very early days. As a 6-year-old, my sense is that the medical profession, as it was, they were working with my parents.
Sure.
And it's very hard for me now, both my parents having passed away, for me to go back and say to them, what do you remember of those days? What were you told? What were you told about the long-term consequences, the long-term side effects? They were obviously told a little bit about the dietary changes that would need to be made. And there were certain things, the insulin, that type of thing. But I really don't have a lot of memory of engagement, conversations with me as the patient. And I think that that's one of the things that really has changed now is the agency, because you have to empower a child who's diagnosed with diabetes to understand not only that the changes that they have to make, but why they have to make them, the impact it's going to have, and the consequences of not making those.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, as you say, that's I think it's a thing that we have to desperately wish for, is that there's greater agency and then there's greater inclusion. So the medical profession has never been a great one for sustaining questions from patients. That's been a criticism for years. And you're right, things are changing now.
Yeah.
I think things are changing quite well now. I would imagine 50 years ago, I wouldn't be surprised if there wasn't a great deal of interaction with you. Now, I'm interested in I understand, because I've had other friends who've had children who've been diagnosed, and it's apparently a very difficult balancing act and a very difficult thing to get right. Talk us through very quickly about those changes. This is a radical change. We're talking not only you now committed to insulin, but you're also, there's a very important regime, dietary regime you need to follow. What was that like?
I think this is one of the points where in my situation that things really did start going off the tracks a little bit, because I was a strong-willed child. I wasn't a particularly active child. I would be far more likely to be the child sitting in the corner reading a book than out there running around playing with my friends or leaping up and down on a tennis court or in a swimming pool or something like that.
Mm.
And at the time, the insulin regime that I was using was a little more complicated. So I don't know whether it's worth diving into what I'm doing nowadays, but nowadays I have insulin pens that I'm able to use myself despite my blindness, because one click of the pen is one unit of insulin.
Right.
And I also am far better able to track my glucose levels and my understanding of the impact of the food that I'm eating. But when I was a young child, there were insulin vials, little bottles of insulin with syringes that they could only track two units at a marking. So it really wasn't, the accuracy was a very different thing to work with.
Far cruder management.
Yes.
Right.
And simultaneously, blood glucose testing, blood glucose monitoring was done in a very different way. And nowadays, there are so many different ways that you can track, monitor, and manage your glucose levels. But back then, they were, again, far cruder and not particularly efficient. Coupled with coupled with that was my, I don't know whether it was lack of understanding, my resistance, my rebelliousness, my just fact that I was a young child.
You were just a kid, hey? Give yourself a break.
And I would go to a school friend's birthday party, and I would drink the cold drinks. I would eat the cake. I would eat the sweets. I would eat the chips. I would have whatever everybody else was having, because at that age, you don't want to be singled out as different. No. And I had no clue of the consequences of that, the longer term consequences. So I think those were some of the factors that were really, really difficult for us to manage. I don't know what my parents knew. I don't know what I knew. Was it that I was informed but just chose to ignore it because, as a child, you think you're invincible.
Sure.
So was it a willful thing? Was it also that I had very little knowledge of other people with diabetes? So I didn't have a sense of community and the constant reminder of other things. Those have all developed for me over the years.
Yeah, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, of course, it's very easy to look back down and even criticize the way you handled it, your folks handled it, the doctors handled it. The fact is that you did emerge on the other side, and it was clearly crude. And I think one must never underestimate the extraordinary changes that have occurred in 50 years, which have made the management of this so much easier. And then there's always the individual component. Some people respond differently to various things.
Correct.
I've known children to have died six, seven, 8 years old, either because they fluffed their own management of this thing, or somebody else did, or it just happened. This is an insidious, quite unpredictable disease, we mustn't forget.
Yes.
So the bottom line is you're now in a regime and you are managing to a degree. You clearly haven't died yet. Did you ever have another drama like a coma again?
Oh, as a child? Yes, multiple times, certainly through my teenage years. I was in and out of hospital. I can't even remember the amount of schooling that I missed because I was constantly in and out of a children's hospital in Durban. And a lot of it was related to the diabetes. There was no other conditions that I experienced. I wasn't the child who was, you know, constantly in and out of hospital because I climbed a tree and fell out or broke a leg or did anything like that. Oh, no. I was the child who would be there getting my diabetes settled and sorted out. And again, as you say, in hindsight, such an important thing. Sure. But, you know, so that seemed to stabilize a little bit more as I grew older, as I took a little more agency of my own management. So at about the age of 14, I started saying to my mom, I will be doing my own insulin injections from now on. And she said, happily, go for it.
Right. Similarly, in those days, let's tell the listeners about that. So insulin injections in those days involved what exactly?
That's a very difficult question to know how to answer. As I said earlier, you know, it was a bottle of insulin. You drew it up into a syringe, injected it into the, you know, and
where?
Voila. Mostly in the thigh, although different areas are used and typically still are used. So it's thigh, back of leg, stomach, sometimes the arms. It really depends on the patients and their preferences. But
now, if you were doing it yourself, what was your preferred location to inject yourself?
Initially thigh and then more recently stomach.
Okay. And you could see in those days. So is it an intricate thing to get a right particular place or doesn't it matter?
No, not really. Sometimes it's a little more painful than other times. Most of the time it's quick, fairly painless, and it's over in a matter of seconds.
Okay, great. So how often did you have to administer this?
With the insulin that I was on when I was a young child, I was injecting twice a day. Mm. And the insulin regime has changed a lot with the introduction of the difference between short-acting insulins and longer acting insulins. So a short acting insulin I would now typically have before each meal, and the longer acting insulin I will have late at night, and it manages my general levels for the period of between 22 and 24 hours.
Okay.
But back then it was just one insulin that was being required to do both. And I think that's also a factor that really does come into it. I haven't really thought about that before. But the other thing that I think needs to be mentioned at about, you know, this time, so we're talking about now early 80s, and I was 14 years old, starting to claim a bit more agency. The other thing that happened at that time was that my father came home from an overseas business trip with my first blood glucose measuring machine, which also had a significant amount of help when we got round to using it, which I will admit wasn't very often, certainly wasn't as often as it should have been. And there are various reasons for that. Along the lines of, well, I've been living with this for 8 years. Do I really need to start doing this? It's going to be sore. It's going to be finicky. It's going to require this. It's going to require that.
Well, so, what does it require? Or in those days, what is it? One of those things where you prick your finger and measure the blood or what?
Yes.
Okay.
But it was one of the, it was a very early version of that, even the machines that are being used now.
Okay.
It took a lot longer. It was a lot more expensive. the strips, the reagents, all of the things we were using. It was a lot more complicated. So yeah, it was just a lot more complex as a process.
Right, a little more very fiddly.
Mm.
Okay. Okay, but it was clearly a game changer because it allowed you to, to track your glucose levels, which is important, of course.
To be honest, if I was using it once every 3 months.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I like I said, I still wasn't an informed diabetic.
Sure.
That really only happened when I was diagnosed with diabetic retinopathy at the age of about 19.
So let's go there because, let's finish school. You matriculated clearly because you managed to get into university, studying archaeology, I recall.
I was studying a Bachelor of Arts, or now a Bachelor of Humanities, and my majors, I was eventually was carrying three majors, English, Classical Civilizations, and Law. And loved you. I absolutely loved you.
Interesting combo.
There's a long story behind that, which isn't relevant to this
show,
story. Yeah, but that's what I was doing.
All right, so you're in university, you're studying. Mm-hmm. At what point did there become a watershed moment? What year of university? First, second?
Yeah. I was in my second year of university. I had just finished exams, and one evening I noticed what I thought was an insect buzzing around in my vision, and I was trying to swat it away and it wouldn't go anywhere. And I noticed there was no sound of an insect. Mm-hmm. I noticed that it was fairly constant where it was in my vision, and I realized that it was actually a spot that appeared in my vision. And that was the kind of crisis moment that took me on the journey of then exploring what was happening with my eyesight and resulted in my blindness 15 months later.
I see. So there was a transition from noticing that to actual blindness.
Correct.
Does that mean that there was a disintegration of vision in those 15 months?
Yes, and it also meant that there was a number of different treatments that we were trying to see if we could clear the vision. So I went to an optometrist who referred me to an ophthalmic surgeon, who then started me on laser surgery to clear the blood vessels on the retina. Because if you go back to what I said earlier about the thickening of the blood due to the glucose levels being elevated, that had also impacted on the blood vessels in my eye. And that spot that appeared in my eye was the first major symptom of one of those blood vessels hemorrhaging. So we tried for, 6-8 months to clear some of those blood vessels using laser surgery and to try and restore normal activity to the retina. And then I had a major hemorrhage in one of my eyes, which resulted in blurred vision in my left eye. And then we continued with the laser surgery, hoping that that would help it to clear. And then I had a hemorrhage in my right eye as well. And that left me seeing the world as though I was looking through a 2-inch frosted shower pane of glass.
Wow.
So it was very blurred, very indistinct. Realistically, it was still functional vision, but not usable vision.
Yes.
I wasn't able really to read. I wasn't able to move around very easily. And at that point, my doctor recommended that we look at changing the treatment. And he offered me the option of optical surgery to essentially shortcut what was going to happen.
And how did that work?
Okay, well, let me just explain that to shortcut what was going to happen. He said to me that if the treatment worked, it would restore my vision.
Wow, that's a hell of a thing to say.
If the treatment did not work, it would result in functional blindness. A degree of, and I actually nowadays, understanding the blindness world so much more, I don't know. What I all I heard was the word blind. That's as I understand it. It was either it would restore my vision or I would be blind. And being at that stage, late 20s going on to 21, I still thought I was immortal and went, of course it's going to work. This is going to give me a chance in a matter of months to go back to living the life that I had been living.
Yeah.
So I went through I had six surgical operations, three first on the left eye. And when those didn't work, two on the right eye. And I want to stop at the two rather than the final one, because after the fifth operation, I was informed by the doctors that they had stabilized the eye, that they were fairly confident that they had solved the problem. And that while I wouldn't have any usable vision in my left eye, I would retain a certain amount of usable vision in my right eye. They just needed to do one final operation, which was a simple cataract operation, because I had developed cataracts in that right eye. Mm-hmm. And during that final operation, the cataract operation, I had a major hemorrhage, and the result of which was that I landed up blind shortly after my 21st birthday.
Wow. So let's talk about the blindness, because, I mean, you and I are veterans of this game. And, you know, I want to do this particularly for the listeners, is that, you know, the word blind is a misnomer. It doesn't by any means, as a rule, mean total loss. I mean, many people are still obsessed with this black blind thing. Mm. But in this instance, what was it? What was the ultimate visual experience?
So at that point, my vision was such that I had no vision. So I was diagnosed as totally blind. What I could do is when I was in direct sunlight or looking directly at an electric light, at a candle flame, I would see streaks of bright light in my vision.
Okay, both eyes.
Both eyes? Well, difficult to say.
Right.
Over the years, that has changed a little bit. So now what I have is, and this was constant at the time, I no longer have those streaks of vision when looking at extreme light sources. What I see now is a constantly changing backdrop of colors. I mean, right now it's kind of a creamy green, light blue, gray. It changes constantly. And there's some rose pink in there as well. So it's an all color rather than single color or no color.
Wonderful. And that's the backdrop. Sounds like your very own kaleidoscope.
Well, that's the next bit that I'm going to say is, simultaneously, I have what I call visual pins and needles in that backdrop. And those are little dots of the most beautiful colors, golds, greens, blues, purples, reds. It's, again, it's all color. And I know I'm not unique in this, but it's certainly not what most people think when they think of blindness.
Yes.
I've now got my eyes shut, which those on the YouTube video will be able to see, but those on the podcast won't. But I'm still seeing those bright, beautiful colors dotting through. And they're constantly, they're like almost like looking up at stars in the sky. But looking up at stars in the sky that are constantly changing their color, or possibly tiny little LEDs that are constantly shifting in color, in shades. And it's absolutely beautiful.
Interesting. You know, I'm relating it to myself. When I shut my eyes, I have a very similar thing. Ever since as a, if I shut my eyes tightly, I would get that same extraordinary galactical kaleidoscopic light show with colors. You're quite right. Which wonderfully will put to bed that wonderful question we always get asked: do you dream in color? Do you still remember color? Let's not go there, because that's not what this podcast is about.
Yeah, but people want to answer that one. If they want to know how I dream, they can read my book, A Different Way of Seeing.
Exactly. But in this instance, I used to call it a bazaar. I used to picture an Oriental bazaar. I don't know why.
I had
this extraordinary idea of a Turkish bazaar. I don't know what that was. I must have read something which stuck in my mind. And that's been my little thing. I still think of it today. All right. So let's move on a little, I think, you know, because we need to...
The meat of the story. Yeah.
Yeah. So now let's move on rapidly here. So we now have diabetes. You are managing your insulin intake. You mentioned earlier there was still a frequency of calamity around diabetes. I'm assuming it didn't stop when you were in 21 and the vision stopped. You still had physical diabetic issues visiting you from time to time over the next 20 odd years. Such as coma?
Well, yes and no. So when I was going through the process of the surgical operations on my eyesight, I finally started seeing an endocrinologist, a diabetic specialist.
Right.
And the first thing he did was he said, "How on earth are you still on such an old fashioned insulin regime?"
Oh, wow.
And I was changed to the more modern insulins, a short acting and a then mixed short and long acting insulin. Right. But I didn't respond as well to those particular insulins. And they needed to change the insulins a number of times before finding a regime that actually worked for me. So
that's interesting.
From that perspective, yes, the comas were still happening. And those did continue for quite a time for a number of different complicated reasons, which may come out in the conversation, but may not. But ultimately, once my insulin, my diabetic management improved, once I started doing glucose tests, once I much more regularly, like at that stage, not quite daily, but still a lot more frequently. Once I was put onto a more modern insulin regime, and that was then adjusted to fit into my schedule, my diet was adjusted to work better with that, things did start improving. And what emerged was, in fact, that I am a fairly brittle diabetic because my sugar levels typically run quite low. And that was a lot of the reason why, once I was under my management of my diabetes, was better. If I did experience hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, or coma, it was because my blood glucose levels were running quite low, which didn't give me as much flexibility as I'd been used to experiencing in terms of what I was doing as I became a more active adult. So, yeah, those did continue.
There's a term for it. It's called hypo-aware, where you are much more aware and responsible about the management of your own issues, right?
Which I was for many, many years. Over the last 3 or 4 years, I found that that has decreased slightly. I could actually just, through the way my body was feeling, I could tell you more or less where my blood glucose levels were with a fair level of accuracy, particularly if I was, my blood glucose was high or if it was running low. I had a very good hypo awareness of that.
Good.
That seems to have changed in the last three years, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now, we're getting into the late 90s here, and clearly something shifts. Because by 2003, we have another milestone, don't we?
Yes.
Which is?
So, I'd changed doctors again because I had moved to Cape Town. So, I was with an endocrinologist who was a superb endocrinologist. And he was managing everything that he was checking, all of the readings on a regular basis. I was actually in the better controlled diabetics in the general scheme of things. So all was going really well. And then sometime during June, one of 2004,
Interestingly, we already knew each other then.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had an experience where I actually developed a kidney stone.
Ah.
And through the removal of that kidney stone, my doctors started being aware that while they'd been monitoring my kidney function levels, so they didn't see anything too concerning, they were aware that that is a very often a side effect of diabetes, a long-term consequence. So they were monitoring it. And when that I had that kidney stone and the kidney stone removed, my kidney function became affected. And at that stage, I started seeing a nephrologist, a kidney specialist as well. So I would see both those doctors twice a year. And they were being very aware of keeping a good eye on things. But at that time, in 2004, the nephrologist said to me, "Lois, I pretty much guarantee that if your kidney function continues to decrease as it is now, you will be on dialysis within 5 years."
Wow.
I had no idea what that meant. I had no idea. And I basically just turned around and said to him, "We'll see. And if it happens, we'll deal with it when it happens."
And clearly, to cut a long story short, it clearly didn't happen in that time frame.
I had 20 years.
20 years.
Of constant or very consistent kidney function.
Yes. Now carry on.
No, I was just going to say that really only changed in 2021 or 2020, probably, because that was the only year I did not see my kidney specialists. I did not see my diabetic specialist because I was advised not to by those doctors because of COVID.
Thank you for listening to A Different Way of Seeing. We would love to connect with you. So find Lois at loisstrachan.com or Facebook, Lois Strachan Speaker. This podcast was edited by Craig Strachan using Hindenburg Pro. Hindenburg, it's all about the story. The credits are done at Naledi Media. Naledi Media, all your vocal needs under one roof. Read by Charlie Jassy. That's it for now. Thank you for joining us and see you next time when we bring you into the world of seeing differently.